We are going to take a look at chapter 36 this week. There are some interesting things in this genealogical process. No, we're not going to trace each person in the genealogy because that would bore me to tears as well. But there are some interesting things that we see in terms of how God closes this chapter with Isaac and the non-chosen line. But before we do that, we ended last week kind of quickly. And the key thing, of course, at the end of chapter 35 is that Isaac is now gone home to be with the Lord, although we know timing-wise it'll be a few years hence. So I thought it might be fun to kind of reflect on and kind of ask, how would you characterize Isaac's life? So we've had Abraham, patriarch number one, and we saw a lot about his character. And then now we have Isaac. And so as we look back on Isaac's life, what kind of things come to mind in terms of your thoughts about Isaac and how you'd reflect on that? Okay, those are two that I thought about. He did demonstrate strong faith, and he also seemed to be a man of prayer in terms of we saw him meditating in the field when his wife or bride-to-be was brought back to him. What else would you say about Isaac?
He wasn't perfect.
He wasn't perfect. I love that. That's the counterbalance to the faith, right? So he was flawed as well, right? So at times he demonstrated great faith. At other times, he demonstrated rather weak faith, just like his father, Abraham. What else?
Favoritism for
one
child.
Ah, yeah, another one. So maybe not great parenting. Might not go as down as number one in the parenting class. So he showed favoritism of children. And in that favoritism, what was he doing? Working against God's will and God's sovereignty in terms of how he had decided the sons were gonna lead. What else?
Willingly obeyed when he was going to be offered up.
Yeah, well, that kind of goes down in the all-time faith category as far as I'm concerned. We talked about that. He was strong enough at that point, I think, to have toppled the old guy. I'm not sure I wouldn't have been hightailing it out of there. But he willingly submitted to that sacrifice. And so we see kind of not only the faith of the father, but the faith of the son and his obedience to his earthly father in that process. So we kind of see some interesting things. So equal parts faith and failure. We kind of got that one, right? We looked at his honoring of God's will as a willing sacrifice, as Linda just spoke, and also the dishonoring of his will, right? The short faith, kind of some of the same failures of Abraham. She's my sister, right? Okay, not my wife. Make sure I don't get in trouble. And then, of course, trying to anoint Ishmael in the process. He was certainly coddled as a child, right? I mean, he was kind of a mama's boy, as was Jacob in the process, but coddled by his mother. One of the things I think is interesting as I think about the patriarchs, he's probably the icon of marriage, right? I mean, he kind of did the process right. He waited. He seems to have had one wife until she died, okay? But also, in her barrenness, he didn't resort to his own schemes and his own plans. He waited on God. And another instance of your reflection that he was a man of prayer, right? So instead of going to human schemes, he prayed, and he relied on prayer to do with different things. Seemed to have a good prayer life, as we mentioned, just that one instance about praying for her barrenness, praying for meditating. Marginal parenting, as David noted, marked by favoritism, okay? Seemed to have lived a relatively quiet life when you compare him to the light of Abraham, right? So we don't hear a lot about Isaac. We hear a lot about him as a younger man. We really don't hear much about him as an older man, as the patriarch. So, you know, compared to Isaac and thus far Jacob, and more to come with drama for Jacob, he lived a relatively quiet life. He was also an inheritor, right, of the promises, which he received directly from God, as well as the blessings from his father. And as Lisa said, he was a flawed follower, just like all of us, okay? So I just like the fact that we get these portraits of individuals that, you know, okay, I get it. Jesus was perfect, but he's God, okay? So I can live with that one. But if all the other Bible characters were kind of perfect like that, then I'd have to say, whew, that seems too hard. So we see real people, how they come to their faith, how they struggle with their faith, and how they live out their faith. And so I think we see just good examples of that. So we move now to chapter 36, and we ask this question, what became of Esau? Right? So what became of Esau? So at a high level, or in short, basically everything that God had promised, right? So God had made a number of promises to Esau, and in the course of this chapter, which is what I think makes the genealogy kind of interesting, we see the outworking of that, and we see how God has fulfilled or fulfills the promises that were made to Esau. So Genesis 36 records his generations along with the fulfillment of the blessings, and then notably his separation from Jacob and his movement to another land. Furthermore, it follows the Genesis pattern. So as we see the closing out of one patriarch and the beginning of a new patriarch, we see the closing out of the non-chosen line, which I think should remind us that all people matter to God. But then we see the narrowing of the focus to the chosen line. So that's what we're going to begin to see as we move into chapter 37 or the rest of the story. Now, last week, I think we got to this question. There are, remember this word, toledoth, it's the Hebrew word. These are the generations of. It's kind of one of the ways to organize the book or see the narrowing of the book. So we actually have two of these toledoths in this chapter. Why do we have two of them? Because this is the toledoth. This is the one set of generations of Esau, but it's used twice. Remember why that was last week? In staff meetings, we call this crickets. You don't hear any noise out there, just the crickets. Okay, so the first reports Esau's posterity that were born in Canaan. Okay, so in verses 1 to 5, we see this first toledoth of the five sons that were born in Canaan. And then the second one, which comes in verses 9 to 19, we see the progeny or the posterity that was born in Edom. Okay, so it's kind of just making a point of the fact that some of the sons or some of his posterity were born in the land and some were born outside of the land. Now, Esau is Edom. We talked about that last week, and Dan was here and he pointed out also that Seir means hairy. So we see kind of the two different things. But Esau equals Edom, which means it's red. We won't go back to that. We looked at it. But back in 25, when he had the stew, he said, here's Esau or Edom. Okay, so red. And then the genealogies, while they can be tedious, they are fruitful to read and to study for their implications. And so there really are some important implications in this one. And so as you do read genealogies, look, I know the names are hard to pronounce, you know, and you kind of tend to just jump over them, right? But the fact is, while you're jumping over the pronunciations, which is okay, try to see if there is something that's a message. We will see kind of a structured message here. So to that point, what we see first of all in verses 1 to 5 are the sons of Esau, so his first posterity, who are born in the land of Canaan, 1 to 5. Then the next thing we see is his resettlement in Edom. Okay, so again, the fulfillment of the fact that he was going to break the yoke of his brother and live separately from him. So we see the fulfilling of that in verses 6 to 8. Then we talk about the further descendants, if you will, of Esau in verses 9 to 19. So another couple generations to give us a sense of kind of the generations preceding. And then we get kind of what I would say is a really big parenthetical. Okay, so 20 to 39, it starts to talk about the nation of Edom. So we're going to look at that. There's some interesting things in here about Edom and its role in Israel's history. So it kind of pauses to let us know that, hey, they didn't move into some vacant, barren land. They came in and dispossessed a whole set of people, and we get a sense of who those people were. But I suspect also that for genealogical records, this was also would have been recorded somewhere to reflect how Esau and the Edomites became one people group and how they intermarried and things like that. And then the chapter ends coming back to Esau again in the last three verses or last four verses of the chapter. Okay, so there is an interesting structure and there's a story to how the genealogy is. So some of them is just straight. We saw like in chapter 5 and so forth, this one begat this one, he died, he got this age, he begat, he died, and it was just kind of giving us a chronology of things. Here we're getting a little bit more about the fulfillment of promises as well as some chronology in the process. Okay? So, someone want to read verses 1 to 5 for me, please?
Esau took his wives and the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Ewan the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Hannah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Bashman, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth, and Ada bare to Esau Eliphaz, and Bashman bare Reuel, and Aholibamah bare Jeush, and Jalem, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau, which were born unto him, in the land of Canaan.
Okay, so we see history in the making here. We see President Obama's clan here. The whole Obama. Get the whole out of there, and we got Obama. Okay, so teasing aside. Okay, we have Ryle in Canaan. Esau had five sons by wives, right? So he has five sons. Eliphaz, Reuel, Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. Now, why do I say I don't know how many wives? Why do I say wives?
Because it doesn't say.
Well, no, it does say. It says he took wives. It gives us the names of them, right? There's Ada, right? There's Aholibamah, and there is Basemath, right? So we do get three names. Why can't I just say it's three wives?
Because you don't know if he has
others. Well, that's true. That's part of the answer, but where would you appeal to support that suggestion?
Past practices of the family?
I'm talking about a fact that might do something. Bobby?
We don't know which of them had boys or girls.
Yeah, okay.
Usually, a lot of the genealogies, you say this one begot this one, this one begot
Yeah.
That's the way it's worded.
Yeah, well, how about because the three names here are different from the three names that were his wives given to us in prior chapters? Okay, so go back to chapter 26 and verse 34. Okay, 26 and verse 34.
You can't remember last week, never mind.
Yeah, right. That's fair. I do study this all week, so I got a little bit of an advantage. I feel a little unfair on these questions, but that's okay. It's humbling. It's helping us with the process. All right, 26:34. What to say? When Esau was 40 years old, he married who? Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Okay, let's fast forward here to 28 and verse 9. Okay, this was back when he saw what Jacob was going to do, right? So he thought he'd kind of court favor with his dad by picking somebody from the family. Poor Esau. And Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Mishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. Okay? So, earlier, he has these three wives. Now we have these three names. So, how many wives did he have? So, it's kind of like the old rhyme, right? If a woodchuck could chuck wood, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck? So, if Isaac could have wives, how many wives would he have? Yeah, seems like it, right?
Too many.
Yeah, too many. That's also a good answer as well. One is plenty. Okay, so the answer is I don't rightly know. Okay, but you know it doesn't malign the text, and you also know I have to take a crack at trying to figure it out. So we're going to take a crack at trying to figure it out. Okay, now let's compare the two lists, okay, to start with. First of all, we had Basemath, the daughter, that's what the D period is, of Elon the Hittite. Okay, in 36, we have Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. So, same father. Same father, yeah. So it could be sisters, that's one option, okay.
But it could be a nickname.
It could be name changes, yeah, or nicknames, okay. So you gotta figure that out. So it could be that. The next one's a little harder, right? We have Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and then we have Aholibamah, daughter of Anna, granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite. So we got different nationality groups, we got different things, okay? So On the surface, you'd say, wow, that certainly seems like it has to be two different women, right? Now, again, the same rule could hold that they just renamed her, but it looks like it's different fathers, right? And then finally, we have Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, sister of Nebaioth, and Basemath, daughter of Ishmael, right? Sister of Nebaioth. So again, just like the first one, Basemath and Ada, okay, we've got the same father. So we got the same options here again. Sisters, he likes the family, he keeps going back, I don't know, whatever. So we could have either...
But this one and that one have the same name.
Yeah, so we could have either three, four, or six potential wives, okay? So three, four, or six. Now, what say you? Three, four, or six? What do you like?
Go back to that.
Which one?
The one that you had all six of them up there.
Yeah.
My gut would be that the first one's the same person.
Yeah.
Just a nickname.
Okay, so that's one.
That's one. And then the next two are two, that's three, and then the next two are different.
So you'll go with four?
No, five.
Five. Oh. Well, why would you... Why don't you hold the same?
The first two.
This is one.
Right. And the second. One and a cross.
Two. Three.
No. Basemath
and Ada are one person.
Right. That's
okay,
one.
Okay, that's one. And one, two, three, four. And that would be five.
There's five children.
Why are the bottom two? Why are the bottom two?
Yeah, if the top one is one, why would the bottom two not be one?
Because I don't see that those two names could even be closely related to a nickname, but they could be.
Yeah, okay. So you go with what was your five? Okay. All right. What else?
I'd say five based on five children.
Right.
So I mean, it doesn't speak of any of them being barren unless they each had multiple children, which doesn't.
There's good logic, but it only gives us three, right? One by one, one by one, three by the third one, in 36, right? So that's why I eliminate five, because it doesn't say any of them were barren. But yeah, okay, that was fine. That's another way to think about it, yeah? What else? Who else? I got anybody for three or four?
God knows.
Absolutely right. No, you're right. We're going to get to that. Okay, so here's kind of how I go up. I think we can eliminate six, right? And why? Well, because there's only five sons and there's no report of barrenness, okay? So I think we can do the same thing for five and that too. Now, that leaves us with either three or four, right? Could be three or four, right? Because I'm going to go with they've renamed in ancient Near East culture. When the woman was married, typically she got a new name. Now, we, in our culture, they would take a new last name typically, right? Here they're taking a new first name, okay? So we look like we have two that would do that. So then the real question comes down to that middle group, right? That second line of comparisons there. Most commentators favor three, okay? And their logic is they cite name changes for each of the women. So that's consistent, okay? So they took new names when they got married. And they go one step further, which is also practiced at times. Sometimes the father's name could have changed. Not necessarily because of the marriage, but for some other reason. So they say that, going back here, they say that Biri the Hittite is the same person as Anna. Okay? And that's how they say that. Now, how do they get there? I do tend to agree with that. They get there. I agree because I think the genealogies get messed up. I mean, we don't, because we're starting the genealogy now,
right?
Okay, and now we're moving through it in 36. So I think we're beginning to see the connection. So those are the ones that are creating the genealogy, and genealogies were important. Okay, so that would mess it up and be incomplete. The rationale for Biri is found in 36:24. So just look ahead in the chapter to verse 24. Okay? Verse 24, it says, these are the sons of Zibeon, Anna. He is Anna. He is the Anna who found the hot springs in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father Zibeon. Okay? So Biri, his original name in Hebrew, actually means my well. Okay? He was renamed Anna after discovering the hot spring. So he became known as Anna, and that's why we get that little detail that he gives us here. So that's how you can start to make a logical connection that the father was renamed as well. Thus, the renamed Judith was likely has the same father, and as Lisa already correctly noted, changes absolutely nothing. But you knew I had to take a crack at it, right? Yes. Pauline. He could have.
And the only ones that are recorded are the mothers of
his sons. Yeah, absolutely correct. Okay. But, and that's true. It could have been. So it could easily have been six, and it could have been that the first three never bore any children. That would be unusual with the biblical genealogies that we sue. Not impossible, as you correctly note, but unusual. So.
But they do typically ignore the daughters.
Oh, they do ignore the daughters, yeah. That's right. That's right. So the other three women could have just had daughters and not sons. I mean, there's a lot of good explanations in the process. Again, I try to look for the easiest solution without killing myself in the process. But, you know, it just kind of bugs me if I can't figure it out. So another one for the list when we get there. But the fact is, it doesn't change anything. But I do think it probably was three. Okay, they had been renamed with one of the fathers renamed. And that this is the genealogical line of Esau that came directly from his posterity before he starts intermarrying down the line with the Edomites that are in the land, okay? So, someone read verses 36 to 8 for me, please.
Then Esau took his wives, his sons, and daughters, and all his household, and went down to the land of
Okay, so now we see this resettlement of Esau, okay? So having noted the sons born in Canaan, verses 6 to 8 record the occasion of his separation from Jacob, which was part of what was prophesied in the blessing. So up till now, the two brothers were in Canaan, likely with Hebron, where Isaac still was, as the base camp, though not necessarily all living there with him, but in that general area, okay? So what was the impetus for the move? Not enough property to support, not enough land to support their property, right? Reminding us of who, what?
Abraham.
Yeah, Abraham and Lot. Same scenario, right? The separation, same impetus of Abraham and Lot. Okay, so that was the kind of stimulus for starting, but of course it's just the catalyst for what had been prophesied in the blessing already. So where they went was from Edom, or from Hebron, kind of this area over here, right, down to Edom. Okay, so that's where he went. Now, Edom is about 20 to 30 miles wide, and it's 100 miles from top to bottom. Okay, so it starts at the Dead Sea, and it terminates down in the Gulf of Aqaba, right? So somebody told me, oh, it was Leah, said my little guys look like snails. You know, if you think of the Red Sea, it looks more like a snail, right? You got the Red Sea, and what do you got off the Red Sea? Two little devil prongs or snail prongs coming up. So this one over here is the Gulf of Aqaba. And that's where it comes down to. So it's a long, skinny country, okay? And it's right today on the Israel-Jordan border, as we talked about. So it empties into the Gulf of Aqaba, into the Red Sea. Now, it was strategically located, as you get into Kings and you look at some of the stories, there's something called the King's Highway. And the King's Highway was a major north-south route that came through here. So either you went to Egypt via this way or via this way. Okay, so it was called the King's Highway. So it was very strategically located in terms of where it was, and it was prospering both from trade and tolls. Okay, so it was actively trading, and they would get tolls going through there. The other thing that's interesting about it is a very natural fortress owing to kind of the geographic nature. It's very mountainous. There's these sandstone cliffs. Its capital at the time was a city called Petra, which is probably
down in here somewhere, okay? And here is why it was such a fortress. That is the path to the city. So Petra was up in the hills, okay? So these are kind of three different looks at, look how small that is, look at the high thing, all right? You got a kind of paved road, and you can see this was a water aqueduct that came down the side. So think about having to defend that pretty easy, right, against a big enemy. Now, this is going to be where Edom gets some of its pride from, its impregnability, and we'll show you kind of some interesting things on that in just a second. So that's kind of just a quick look at Edom itself, all right? Now, Edom had a very prominent role in biblical history, okay? So Edom was, you know, mentioned multiple times as we go through the Bible. The first time we heard about it was it settled by the Horites, okay? And we go all the way back to remember the issue when Lot had been taken. So Chedorlaomer came in and took them. The Horites were one of the groups who were subjugated by Chedorlaomer when he came through and did that thing way back in Genesis 14. So that's the first time we see and hear about it. It was dispossessed by Esau, okay? So turn ahead into Deuteronomy just to show you where we get this information. Deuteronomy chapter 2, right, the second law. The new generation is having everything recounted right before they go into the land. And in chapter 2 and in verse 12, first of all, it says, the Horites formerly lived in Seir, okay, so we see the same things, but the sons of Esau, what? Dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which God gave to them. So we see kind of the, you know, the outworking of God's plan, right? So the Israelites were going to get the promised land, and this was a land that was promised apparently to Esau, and he dispossessed them. It's repeated again in verse 22. Now, Edom was famously denied Israel's safe passage in the Exodus. Okay, so go to Numbers chapter 20. All right, so Numbers is the book of the wilderness wanderings. So all you who are doing your read through the Bible, you'll get all these little cute things when you come on Friday. Chapter 20, and beginning at verse 14, okay, it says, from Kadesh, okay, so if we go back here, Kadesh, which is referring to Kadesh Barnea, right? Remember what Kadesh is, where they were, and what did they do from Kadesh? They sent the spies into the land. They're too big. Okay, you're going to spend a lot of time out in the wilderness as a result of that little whiny act. Okay, so Edom then, from Kadesh Barnea, Kadesh, Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel. Now that's interesting. Thus your brother Israel, right? Okay, so you see the clans, right? Kind of an interesting statement there. Has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us. Okay, so the recognition in Scripture is this is his, you know, brother nation, okay, has befallen us. Our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through your field or through a vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway. Remember I said king's highway, okay? Not turning to the right or to the left until we pass through your territory. Edom, however, said to him, what? You shall not pass through us, or I will come out with the sword against you. Right? Prophecy again, right? There's going to be discord between the two. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass on my feet, nothing else. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Okay, but thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him, right? So this is why we think about it as the wilderness wanderings. You know, you go all different maps are kind of wandering around. They went way down, right, to be able to get through and then come back up into the area, okay? So they just simply wanted to take the shortcut, and brother nation said no. Now, it was later conquered and subjugated by King David, right? So go to 2 Samuel, chapter 8. Verses 13 and 14. Okay, 2 Samuel chapter 8
talking about David's triumphs early on in his reign. But then we get to verses 13 and 14, and it says this: So David made a name for himself when he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons in Edom. In all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants of David, and the Lord helped David wherever he went. Okay, so we see that Edom, the brother nation, was subjugated. So this kind of tension continuing throughout Israel's history. And then there's this whole minor prophet that's devoted to it, okay? So everybody knows exactly where Obadiah is, right? Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, H-J-A-O-J. Okay, so Hosea, Joel, Amos, let's get to Obadiah. One chapter, 21 verses, okay? And the whole book is about God's judgment on the Edomites, okay? So it starts in chapter and verse 1, it says, the vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, okay? We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise, and let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. Oh, there's that despised word we heard this morning. Okay. Now, why? Okay, verse 3. What does it say? The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You live in the clefts of the rock. In the loftiness of your dwelling place, you say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Okay, so pride. Pride in what? In their impregnability. Okay, you saw that. It was a fortress, but yet it was defeated. Okay, and then he goes on through verses 4 through 9. Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves come to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? Da-da-da-da-da. Keeps going down then. Verse 9. Then your mighty men will be destroyed, O Teman, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau. Interesting, right? Edom, Esau. You see the connection. By slaughter. Now, that's the first reason, their pride. What's the second reason? Verse 10. What's it say? Okay, so the second reason that God's going to judge Edom is because of their persecution of Israel. Okay, so we again see 10 through 14, we see that whole thing playing out. Because of the violence of your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be cut off forever on the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem. You too were as one of them. So basically Edom piled on. Right, during all these periods of time, back and forth, whenever they could have things. And we'll see this in the period of the judges, typically. Okay, and then finally in verses 15 to 21, we're told, for the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations, so God's general judgment, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Okay, so the day of the Lord, that's going to be God's second coming and the judgments. And so God's going to come in judgment and remember all these things. So Edom had a prominent role. It was constantly a source of irritation to the nation of Israel, or Judah and Israel, when they had the divided kingdoms. It's not surprising, right? So modern-day Edom is a desolate military outpost of Jordan, okay, on the western border, and the eastern border is the nation of Israel, or the Negev, where the, you know, the battle was. And you said, Ken, you'd been down there, and it's pretty desolate. Yeah, okay. Populated by some Bedouin tribes, okay? So the story of Edom then is the historical outworking of the Esau-Jacob brotherhood of nations focusing on their perpetual enmity towards one another. So the older shall be ruled by the younger, and the older will rebel against the younger, okay? So that's the enmity that was prophesied in the blessing of the two sons, leading us to see that the original Arab-Israeli conflict is not a new thing, okay? It's just no surprise that this is all going on over there, right? Because all the way God set it up and
so
what we see.
All, I've always thought the Arab-Israeli thing was Ishmael versus Isaac, but Esau is also considered part of the Arab part.
Yeah, Ishmael was the original one, and it moves through over here, and you got all the different things.
His family was married into it, too.
Right, Right, remember? He took a wife from Ishmael's family? Yeah, so you see the two together, and yeah, so that's that whole kind of, just think of everything, if you would, east of the eastern border, you know, just think of the Galilean Sea, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, everything this way. And if you just look at the Middle East today, you got a map over there, which some people love and other people hate. But the fact is that there's a map. Yeah.
Need a blow up of the Middle
East.
That's about right here.
Yeah.
Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee.
Right. And then you got that tiny little spit of land that's Israel, right? And what do you got over there? Those monster Arabian nations,
yeah.
Right? Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, you know, all the different things over there. So it's kind of interesting, right? So this little nation, right, even today, just hangs in there, right? Obviously, America's been behind them for years, and we see a renewal of that in the policies of our current administration. But, you know, I think that's good for America, right? Because what does it say? He will bless those that bless him, and he will stomp on those that don't bless him. All right? Okay, so interesting scenario. All right, somebody read 9 to 19 for me, please.
Steve?
Yeah, sorry.
You maybe clarify for me. Verse 6 says, then Esau took his wives. Can we assume this is after Isaac has been dead and buried?
Say that. Where are you? Then Esau took his wives?
So, you know, then Esau took his wives and his family and all and moved. My question is, do we assume that's after Isaac has died and been buried?
Yeah, it is.
We don't know.
It's chronologically probably before he actually dies. Because if you remember back, you weren't here in chapter 35. When it says that he died, he actually lived 12 more actual years. Okay? So they buried their father, and I think it would have been after that he had buried that time.
And then Esau would have come back.
Yeah, well, Esau was still in the land to start with, okay? He was in the land with his brother, right? They were there. They came together for their father's funeral. They were still in the land. He had his first set of children in the land, and then he moved out, okay?
Okay, so I guess that's my question then. Esau took his family and moved out after Isaac.
Probably after Isaac died. I can't tell you dogmatically. I'd have to go back and do some research. Okay. But, yeah, likely after he died. I doubt that he would have caused his father that problem while he was alive.
I just couldn't find specifics.
You got to really dig around. No, and even as I said last week, trust me on the 12 years, right. You can figure it out based upon the age of Joseph and backing things up and everything else. But it's, yeah. So I'm presuming it would have been after he died.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So any other questions? All right.
There's clearly a distinction between those who are born in the land and those who are not born in the land.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any understanding of why that is, what it implies, and how that applies today? Is there a distinction between those who live or born in the land?
Yeah, I don't think so, because they did not have purely Jewish heritage relationships at that point in time either. So he'd already married outside of the family structure there. I just think he's noting a historical reality in that case. I don't think there's any distinction today that there's kind of like a third class. There's, you know, the promised people, there's the non-chosen race, and there's kind of these half-breeds in between. I mean, I would say it would be similar to the New Testament would look at the Samaritans, right? So they were intermarried Jew and Gentile, right? So they were called out in a sense, right? So they might have been despised by both Israel and Arabs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're not really an Arab and you're not really an Israeli. It's kind of like the Samaritans were despised by the Jews and then the Gentiles and different things. So it's just noting that I think that they were born there. I don't know if anybody else has any perspective on that, but I don't see any significance to that. Good question, though. Interesting.
Just thinking.
That's a dangerous thing to do, that just thinking thing. It's good. It's great. Scripture should make us think. All right. Somebody read 9 to 19 for me, please.
These then are the reports of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's son. Eliphaz, the sons of Esau's wife, Lithis were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gata, and Kenneth. Jinnah was a Kanban of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Ada. These are the sons of Reuel, Nahath, and Zerah, Shema, and Mizah. These were the sons of Esau's wife, Ishmael. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anna, and the daughter of Zibeon. She bore to Esau Jeus and Jaram and Korah. These are the chief sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, who firstborn Esau, chief Teman, chief Omer, chief Zepho, chief Kenneth, chief Korah, chief Gatam, chief Alemet. These are the chief descendants from Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Ada, the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahath, chief Zerah, chief Shema, chief Mizah. These are the chief descendants from Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Ishmael. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Oholibamah, chief Jeus, chief Jaram, chief Korah. These are the chief descendants from Esau's wife, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anna. These are the sons of Esau. That is Edom.
All right, I think we got to give her a little hand for that. Although I got to say, I like the pronunciation of Oholibamah. We're not getting any political issues. It was kind of cute. Okay, so we now see basically the section begins with the generations of Esau, now born to him in Edom, okay? So basically these are his grandsons, all right? To his son Eliphaz, there were five sons plus one more via a concubine Eliphaz, okay? Timnah, by a concubine of Eliphaz, who is Timnah. To his son Reuel, Basmath, four sons. And to his sons by Oholibamah, none are recorded. So that's kind of interesting. So that would get back to Pauline's comment earlier about it's possible there could have been other wives and there were no children, because here's an example of one when there are none recorded. Okay, so maybe just daughters or something else. Now, what is the point of verse 12a? What's the point of the first verse? It says, Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. What's the point of that verse there? Jack. And that would be a very good guess, okay? So first of all, we should kind of poke our eyes up because it's the only concubine mentioned. So it's a child from other than, there were probably other concubines perhaps, but they stopped to pull this one out. So it is parenthetical, and I believe the point of recording it is to record the birth of a figure and a nation that will be prominent in Israel's subsequent history, okay? So Amalek or the Amalekites. Now, Amalek and the Amalekites were among Israel's bitterest enemies, okay? So another group of Arab descendants, bitter enemies. They fought against them in Exodus. We won't go to all these things, okay? Exodus 17 and verse 8. Comment, Ken?
No.
Okay.
No.
God used Amalek as part of a consortium formed by Moab to go against the apostate Israel, right? So remember the book of Judges, right? It's a apostasy, oppression, deliverance, seven different cycles of that. God using the nations around that to bring his judgment to them. So they were part of the consortium that piled on there. They led to King Saul's downfall, right? So back in 2 Samuel chapter 8, as he had been anointed, right, Samuel told him, go ahead and what? Utterly destroy the Amalekites. And this is kind of one of those cases where the Hebrew word is kind of fun. It's that thing that looks, this can be an H, this is not, it's a K, so haramim, just haramim the whole way. So I think of Boca Haram as an answer. You know, it's just kind of funny little things that you see and you look at it, whether they're the same thing or not, I don't know. I just kind of like to play on the words. But he was told to utterly destroy the Amalekites and the Amalekite king, right? So what does he do instead? Yeah, and then what did he do when he was confronted by Samuel? Yeah, he tried to blame somebody else and said, why? Well, I would have thought the Lord would want me to keep the good stuff. Right? And the people wanted it.
Sacrifice.
Yeah, sacrifice, okay? So we go through there. So we see that also they played a significant role in that. So again, the Amalekites, exactly right, Jack. It's recorded again because of its prominence in Israel's future history. So combination of sons and grandsons, 14 in all, 13 are recorded. One phantom, this Korah, okay? If you go back and look at the names, is where this Korah come from, rose to become chiefs in Edom. Now, Korah could have also been born of a concubine, but because that particular son didn't have any particular influence or prominence in future Israel, maybe may or wasn't recorded, but okay, it was there. So nothing dogmatic is to be attached to the title of chiefs. It simply denotes that they rose to positions of prominence in the land. Okay, so think of them like tribes or tribal heads or family heads in the process. All right? So I'm going to read this next section because it's long and we need to go. All right, chapter verses 20 to 39. These are the sons of Seir the Horite. Okay, so now we're looking at the inhabitants of the land. Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, and Anah, and Dishon, and Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hemam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. Oh, there we go, interesting. These are the sons of Shobal, Alvin, and Manahath, and Ebal, and Shepho, and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon, Ai, Ayah, and Anah. He is the Anah who found the hot springs, remember we read that earlier, in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father Zibeon. These are the children of Anah, Dishon, Aholabama, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Dishon, Hemdan, and Eshban, and Ithran, and Cheran. These are the sons of Ezer, Bilhan, and Zaavan, and Achan. These are the sons of Dishon, Uz, and Aran. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, Chief Lotan, Chief Shobal, Chief Zibeon, Chief Anah, Chief Dishon, Chief Ezer, Chief Dishon, Dishon, a little different. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites according to their various chiefs in the land of Seir. Now, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the sons of Israel. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhabah. Then Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, became king in his place. Then Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites became king in his place. Then Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the field of Moab, became king in his place. And the name of his city was Avith. Now Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekah became the king in his place. Then Samla died, and Shaul of Rehoboth on the Euphrates River became king in his place. Then Shaul died, and Baal Hanan, the son of Achbor, became king in his place. Then Baal Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar became king in his place. And the name of his city was Pau, and his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, daughter of Mezahab.
Just,
There are people that go through and trace all this stuff, I got to tell you. It's kind of fun to read. Praise God for people that like to do that stuff. There's a lot of speculation. A lot of these names are the same. You can't be dogmatic about who connects to who, but we see the different kind of things. Okay? So, bottom line, verses 20 to 39 capture the inhabitants of the land of Edom who were subdued by Esau and enter into the making of the Edomite country. Okay? So we see the intermarrying. Their patriarch is Seir the Horite, who has seven sons, who are the chiefs of the Horites, and one daughter, Timnah, the sister of Lotan. These sons, in turn, fathered 19 grandsons, or grandsons, and one daughter, one granddaughter. And it's pointed out, again, that this Anah is the one that discovered the hot spring. So again, I think that's probably to potentially connect it to the name of Beeri and connect the two people there. Surely the group subsequently intermarried with Esau's clan, but we're only given genealogies to the second generation to get the main point. And then 31 to 39 go on to identify a succession of kings that ruled in Edom as well, okay? Before the kings of Israel. Now here's where the liberal scholars try to crack the veracity of scripture, right? Moses wrote this well in advance of the kings of Israel, right? So how could he have known this? How could it really have been Moses as the writer? So how would we defend that, or how would we push back on that liberal argument?
Every word is inspired by God,
and the inspired words of God in chapter 17 and verse 6 and all the way back in 35 verse 11 and following is that what? Kings would proceed from Israel. So basically it's pretty simple. He simply wrote as he believed, right? And under inspiration in the process. Okay, so no mess there. So from the third generation onward, it's seen that Edom was ruled by kings. I actually think it was probably at the same time as the chiefs. And I think the chiefs were probably the ones that appointed the kings. Okay, so they had chiefs in the land, and they probably got together and anointed or appointed a king of the land, right? And the reason I say that's probably the case is if you look at the genealogy of the kings, there are no descendants or no succession. Okay, so just different men were anointed at different times. Okay, so that's kind of the thing. Again, remember I said I think this is one big parenthetical. Again, to give us historical perspective, you can look at the book of First Chronicles. You'll see a lot of names and similar overlaps in names in the process. Okay, so final three verses or four. Somebody read those for me, please.
Now these are the names of the chiefs descended from Esau, according to the families and their localities by their names. Chief Timnah, Chief Alva, Chief Jetheth, Chief Oholibama, Chief Elah, Chief Kanon, Chief Kenaz, Chief Teman, Chief Mibzah, Chief Magdiel, Chief Aram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is Esau, the father of the Edomites, according to the habitations in the land of their possession.
Okay, very good. All righty. So the genealogy concludes returning to Esau. Now, why does he come back? Why does it come back to Esau? Yeah, okay. So it's closing the whole thing out. I think deliberately, though, to reestablish his sovereignty. So the chapter's got these bookends. It starts with Esau's genealogy. We've had this kind of parenthetical in the middle, right, to talk about the Edomites. And now it comes back and says, okay, let's be reminded, okay, of who it is in the process. And again, I think further supported by this fifth time, we see that Esau is Edom. So I think that the writers want us to make it very clear that, look, this is Esau's territory. Now, what's the nature of this final list? What's the nature of this final list? How's it organized?
By families and localities.
Okay, right. So by the land, by families and localities, okay? So it re-expresses the initial list of king of Esau's chiefs, right? Providing a geographic emphasis versus a genealogical one. In other words, it's not a new list of guys. Now, how do we know? Well, the clues are found in verses 40 and 43, right? In verse 40, it says their localities, right? And in verse 43, the habitations in the land of their possessions. So it's just giving us a geographical organization of where these chiefs were. It's not a new list, rather the names of the capital cities where they ruled, and it just so happened that two of the capital cities were named after the chiefs. Okay, so Timnah, or Teman, and Kenaz were named after the chiefs. So that's really all that's going on there, okay? The other guys didn't take their things. So then the genealogy concludes with an emphasis on Esau's possessing of the land. Okay, so again, it goes back and closes out by saying Esau is the main guy, and this is what's going on here. Okay, so that's how the genealogy ends. Kind of a couple closing thoughts, and I'm going to introduce the rest of the book here. Note how completely God's promises by way of Isaac's blessings are fulfilled. So even though it can get a little weary or tedious reading all the names, it does have a significant purpose, right? We see all the progeny. We see that he settles away from fertility in the hill country of Seir, a mountainous area. We see he breaks the yoke of his brother, right? All things that were predicted. Ultimately, they will be decimated, as we saw in the book of Obadiah, also as referenced in the book of Ezekiel. And none of which should surprise us, right? Because of Esau's flippancy with regard to first his birthright, which he's traded for a bowl of that red stuff, the stew, okay? And he was fleshly versus spiritual, typically and always indulging his physical desires above any other scenario. So all of which is affirmed in the New Testament. So just turn over here to Hebrews, and the writer of Hebrews gives us a pretty clear picture of how they viewed good old Esau. Chapter 12, verses 16 to 17, say this. Giving some, you know, starting at 14, pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. There be no immoral or godless person like who? Esau. Who did what? Sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance. Ah, pretty interesting statement there, huh? Though he sought for it with tears, all right? So crocodile tears, no real repenting or penance, just wanted to get past it and get what he wanted, okay? A few kind of closing implications. Human sin doesn't change God's plan. We've seen a lot of it in these scenarios. God's blessing to the non-elect is still abundant. I mean, we see God's common grace in the world today. Also reminding us, though, just how great and precious should be saving grace and God's process of regenerating unto eternal life. All right, so that's the genealogy. Quick introduction here to what we're going to see for the rest of the book. Okay, so the ascendance of Joseph, and as I call it, the rest of the story. Okay, so basically Jacob's patriarchy. So this is really Jacob's patriarchy, right? So Joseph is not a patriarch. We generally say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Jacob and Joseph, but it really is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the patriarchs. But the story of Jacob's patriarchy is primarily told through the account or the life and times of Joseph, right? Now, Genesis 37 to 47 record how God used Joseph to preserve Egypt and the surrounding nations and to preserve and prosper what will become the nation of Israel. In so doing, God demonstrates his power and sovereignty over the affairs of men. We also see how one godly man can make a difference, right? So you look at this whole historical account. We look at the other 11 sons and kind of their legacy of what they've done. You see one godly man makes a very significant difference. So anytime you think, well, it's just me, or what can I do? I'm just one person. Well, Joseph was just one person too, but he was perfectly submitted and obedient to the Lord, and God used him in a very mighty way. So Joseph, along with Paul and Christ, I think is the epitome of Hebrews 12:15. We just read it. I won't say it, read it again, just to paraphrase. What it said, don't let a root of bitterness develop in you. Now, if anybody, you know, had reason to have a root of bitterness, right, sold by his brothers, misaccused by Potiphar's wife, thrown into prison, gets the one guy out, forgets about him when he gets there, right, and finally gets back. But then we have that amazing statement at the end of the book, right? What does it say at the end of the book? What is
you meant it for bad, but God meant it for good.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, if I was to say, boy, I wish I could do that. You know, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to preserve many, right? So really understanding that. It's a good another thought for us as we kind of continue to move into this bringing things together. Now, the narrative returns again to Jacob only to record his death, final blessing, and burial, right? So it does come back to him. We get his final blessing, or his death, but his final blessing to first Jacob's sons, I mean Joseph's sons, then to the his own sons, okay, then his death, and then the final act with Joseph and dying, and we already talked about the verse. So just quickly, here's how we'll lay out. 37, he's going to go, I call it, from privileged to peddled, right? So he was the multivariegated son, right? The privileged son, the special one, and then he goes from that to being sold or peddled, only for 20 shekels. He didn't even get the price of a slave, right, to the passing caravan. Then we see this kind of account of Judah's progeny and his prostitute and his shame in chapter 38. And then we see 39 to 41, this kind of range of what Joseph goes through, right? He goes from power, right, the head of Potiphar's house, to prisoner, right, then to preeminent. I mean, other than the Pharaoh, he's the most preeminent guy in the land, all right? So you see this interesting progression. And throughout that, we see his amazing administrative and organizational skills. We see the brothers' preservation and preference in 42 to 45, right? So when they go down for getting the food, right, he puts the money back and he kind of brings them back together. And then we see the family reunion in chapter 46, okay, brought back together. 47, prosperity and posterity in Goshen. So you see the nation is really birthed and born and grown in that period of time. It becomes very prosperous, leading us then into the book of Exodus and the persecution and then God taking them out. But we see this growing of the nation, right? Many descendants in the process. 48, Joseph's portion. Okay, so he talks about what Joseph will get through his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Then we have this patriarchal pronouncements, or I would say even prophecies, and we'll get another amazing messianic prophecy in this section. We'll take a look at that when we get there. And then finally, the magnanimous pardon is what I call the last part, right? So the brothers finally figured, oh man, the old man's dead. He's going to get us now. And we get this amazing statement from Joseph and kind of who he is and what he does. So amazing process. So that's 46. This is what we have coming. No idea how long it'll take us to get through it, but we see it's one big story and a lot of great stuff. So any questions before we close? Thoughts, questions, comments?